This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Alzheimer's is a devastating disease in which you first lose your memories and then lose yourself. For years, researchers have been struggling to find the causes of Alzheimer's with the hope for a cure. That has proven elusive. There are other memory-related conditions that many of us will face as we age, dementia among them. The story here is a bit brighter. In fact, doctors are discovering more about the role to be played by diet and exercise, education, social interaction, and delayed retirement, actually, in staving off dementia and even postponing the onset of Alzheimer's. In advance of the Charlotte Neuroscience Foundation's symposium, Alzheimer's Disease, the Challenges of Today and the Promise of Tomorrow, we welcome three medical experts working on ways to keep our brains healthy as we age. Dr. Charles Edwards is medical director of the Memory Center, Charlotte. They care for patients in the early stages of memory loss and for the families who, in turn, care for loved ones with memory challenges. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Hayes Willen is a primary care physician in Charlotte and Senior Vice President of Physician Services for Novant Health. He also serves as chair of the Charlotte Neuroscience Foundation and is the author of Fuel Your Body, Feed Your Mind. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you.
Both are with us in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Dr. John Rady, best-selling author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, and Go Wild, which explores mental and physical health. With those books, he has established himself as one of the world's foremost authorities on the brain-fitness connection. And Dr. Rady is also Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Rady, thank you for being with us as well.
Great to be with you.
Alzheimer's and dementia. Let's get a couple of definitions on the table so we can move on. Alzheimer's and dementia are part of the same spectrum, are they not? Define those two terms.
Well, dementia is an overriding term,
right,
and it is a group of symptoms. There are five major types of dementia. Alzheimer's being the leading, the most people that get Alzheimer's disease or get dementia after the age of 70 or 65 to 70, 70% of those people will have Alzheimer's disease. Then there's another category called vascular dementia, which is related to cardiovascular disease. A third is called dementia with Lewy body, which is associated with Parkinson's disease. And then there's a terribly troubling aspect of dementia called frontotemporal dementia, which affects people's behavior and their ability to speak. In another category is the dementia that's associated with traumatic brain injury, dementia pugilistica, that boxers get. So each one of these is a category or a part of the dementia, but each one is a specific type.
But Alzheimer's is the one that seems to get most of the press. It's the one that garners most of the attention. Is that because it is the worst of them all? Is it because it's completely uncurable? Is it because we don't really know, completely understand the causes of it? Why is that the king?
Yeah, and it can be a spectrum, right? Like that cognitive decline can progress into Alzheimer's. And so Alzheimer's tends to be the end result, which over a 20-year period, you can have mild progressive cognitive decline, which ending in Alzheimer's disease, which then at that point is really difficult, if not impossible, to treat.
You mentioned the cardio, the vascular dementia, and you were a cardiac and thoracic surgeon at one point in your career, and you switched. I guess you found this passion for Alzheimer's treatment after caring for some of your elderly patients. Is that because some dementias are caused by cardiovascular problems?
Well, that's an interesting question because my experience as a cardiovascular surgeon brought a perspective to this that's a little bit different from, say, a neurologist or a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very in tune to vascular contributions to one of the hot topics right now is what's called mixed dementia, which Hayes was just alluding to, that some patients have a neurodegenerative component, which would be Alzheimer's, and then they have a major vascular component, and they get dementia, but it's not as pure as just declining Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Rady, let me bring you into this conversation. Even if we don't get Alzheimer's as we age, or even some forms of dementia, most people do experience some memory issues later in life. Do we understand why we become more forgetful? And if following your plan of exercise, would we be able to stave off some of that memory loss?
Well, I think it's sort of inevitable to have some kind of memory loss for all of us as we age. And you know, the brain lives well if we keep it in good shape, but it has an endpoint, and we begin to lose nerve cells and have our brain shrink and all that. But what we've learned, what was so exciting in the mid-90s, that exercise was a potent way of preventing the onset of what we call cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. And this was a big surprise. And this led to what I call the revolution in neuroscience, really, to try and understand why exercise was such a powerful intervention and prevention of cognitive decline, and then leading on to dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah. It really fueled the fire of heretofore neuroscience departments that were looking at the classic neuroscience of how our brains dealt with emotions and mood and movement and learning. But then all of a sudden, hey, there's a way that we can really prevent our faculties from withdrawing. And now we know so much more. There are so many papers. Every week I get sent at least 80 new abstracts from the National Institute of Health on exercise and its effect on the brain.
Which is more important? Because as you get older, you see older people doing a lot of the crossword puzzles, and they do that to keep their my grandmother. So I do this because it keeps me active. It keeps me my thought processes working. Which is more important, doing that, those brain exercises, or doing physical exercises?
Yeah.
What do we know?
You know, there's an explosion. John's right. There's an explosion of data that's coming out that it's probably all of those things. That when you work out of Risa Sperling out of Johns Hopkins suggested that a lot of this cognitive decline might happen 20 years before you even see changes. But even at that point, there's 50 to 60% of neurons that are lost. And so we think that, and you mentioned it, people that are prolonging their retirement age, that are still working, they're taking classes, that brain stimulation is really important.
Talk to me about what you just said. You said that a lot of this decline happens sometimes 20 years before we recognize it. That means as we sit here, we could be setting ourselves up.
The data on normal cognitive aging shows that actually our cognitive skills peak at the age of 25.
Great, thanks.
And and so we are well down on the slope of that line. And there are actually, it's interesting, Salthaus did a lot of studies on this and did a lot of testing. And there are two things that are preserved as we age. One, go figure this, antonyms. If you test people on antonyms, they come up with the opposites better as they age. Huh. And the second is an entity called crystalline memory. And what it does is it kind of dovetails into judgment and life experiences. And so we do better on that, kind of things like, what happens if you jump into a raging river? We'll say, well, don't do that. Okay, so everything else declines. And you were mentioning something about names. In the clinic, we don't really...
Before we start on that, just for our listeners, I said I struggle with remembering names. I really do. I try hard to remember names, and I just can't do it.
Well, in the clinic, it's interesting because oftentimes we have people come in and they will have parents that have had Alzheimer's, and they have what's called subjective memory loss. That means you don't really have it, but you think you do. And they are terribly worried because they can't connect with names. And my point to them is I don't really worry about names in the evaluation, and I don't really worry about numbers either. Now, I do worry about episodes. You know, wasn't it nice to be with your son and daughter last night? And they say, I don't remember that. Now, that's a red flag. But I make the point about people being in a restaurant. Someone will walk into a restaurant, and they'll go to their wife. Who is that guy? I saw him. I should know him. And she'll say, I'm sorry, sweetheart, I can't help you. And then you realize that you've ruined your whole meal because you've been focused on this guy's name. And then he comes over to talk to you, and he has no idea who you are either. So, you know, so this name thing is really out of proportion.
It's more being out of context, isn't it?
Exactly.
You're seeing somebody you know, but they're not in the setting that you know them from. We're going to talk a lot in this hour about the importance of diet and exercise and what you are discovering about how that impacts the brain and your memory. But I want to get back to Alzheimer's for just a couple of seconds, because that is the big dog in the room here. The search for a cure for Alzheimer's has been described as disappointing. A cure for cancer has also been elusive. So what has been making finding a cure for Alzheimer's so difficult?
Well, you know, when we talk about Alway Alzheimer, had a patient that he diagnosed the first time in 1901. And if you look at today, we have no more idea or no more impact on the disease than he did on that day when he first diagnosed it, as far as being able to stop the decline. We don't understand really what causes it. And we have some medications that can alter behavioral problems and the depression and things that are associated with it. But we have hit a dead end. Of the top 10 diseases that of the top 10 mortality diseases in the United States, Alzheimer's is the only one that we don't have any therapy for at all.
And it's the third leading cause of death, is it not?
And it's the most expensive.
The Alzheimer's Association says that although current Alzheimer's treatments cannot stop Alzheimer's from progressing, they can temporarily slow the worsening of dementia symptoms. How temporary is that slowing?
Well, the studies show that the people that do get a benefit, somewhere between 12 and 18 months, but the responsiveness to these medications, the responsiveness to those medications is based on genetics. Some people get a real benefit, and some people don't.
Okay.
But that's been disappointing.
Now, UCLA has documented the first reversal of memory loss from Alzheimer's ever. Do we understand what's going on here in this study that I think this recently released in October of last year?
Yeah, I mean, that gets back to what people are doing across the country, and I'd like to hear what Dr. Rady has to say about that too. But I think they're one of the first ones to say, look, let's don't try to focus on one particular cure. Let's really look at let's optimize a lot of the things that are going on in the body with metabolites and hormones, and try to really optimize everything that could potentially go wrong in the body. And so they're putting nutrition in the equation, they're putting exercise, and everything that we can do to mitigate those problems, along with some of the drug therapies, have proven to be really exciting. And I think the studies are early. They've got a small patient panel on that, but it's pretty exciting work.
But they have reversed Alzheimer's?
Those patients have subjectively showed some improvement on cognitive function, but then they've also looked at PET scans and some of the studies like functional MRIs that have actually shown improvement in the hippocampal imaging on the brain. So, yeah, I mean, it looks like they have actually proven that you can reverse this process.
And they're doing this how?
Well, in this study, and this study is only 10 patients.
Okay.
It came out in March of last year. And a lot of the patients had what's called mild cognitive impairment. So you have this, you have normal cognitive aging, and you have mild cognitive impairment, and then you have Alzheimer's. And so we don't really know exactly what the cognitive status of these people were before they went in. But this is a flicker of hope.
Okay. That's Dr. Charles Edwards. Also with us, Dr. Hayes Willand and Dr. John Rady. They're all Alzheimer's and memory experts. And when we come back, we'll talk about exercise and diet and how it impacts your brain. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. This week at the Marriott South Park, actually today and tomorrow, the Charlotte Neuroscience Foundation is hosting Alzheimer's Disease, the Challenges of Today and the Promise of Tomorrow. It's pretty much for professionals, but I think also for caregivers, and you can sign up for that. You can get information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Joining us in the studio, Dr. Charles Edwards, Medical Director of Memory Center Charlotte, Dr. Hayes Willand, Primary Care Physician and Senior VP of Physician Services at Novant Health, the author of Fuel Your Body, Feed Your Mind, and joining us by phone, Dr. John Rady, who will be a guest on the panel today or tomorrow. from the Harvard Medical School. He's also the author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. We have now turned our attention to prevention in many cases. We can't find a cure for Alzheimer's, or haven't been able to so far, but I'm told that we've now turned our attention to prevention. Is that where diet and exercise comes into the equation?
Well, let me start off. It's all the things that you've sort of alluded to at the very outset of the show. It's everything. But diet and exercise are crucial, as well as being involved with others, as well as continuing to challenge your brain. I think I like to think of challenge as the way to keep our brains young, to keep our bodies young, to keep our brains growing. What we want to do is keep what's called our brain's neuroplastic at the best level that we can. And one of the best ways of doing that is exercise. Certainly, diet and using our brains come into play, and when as well as feeling good and not feeling depressed and not feeling anxious and not feeling stressed. All those things are over time can be toxic to our brains and hasten the onset of cognitive decline.
Let's talk about why that might be happening in the brain just through exercise. I mean, we know that exercise as a young person increases blood flow through the brain. Is it simply allowing us to grow new neurons or slow down the decline of the number of neurons that we have, or is it actually flushing the brain out in some way, allowing it to stay healthy? What's going on there?
Well, that's partly the issue, is that you're making more blood vessels. You're making more highways to bring the blood up there and bring more oxygen and bring the waste out. But also you're acting on the brain cells themselves, because our brains evolved over 400 million years to help us be the best movers that we can. So many of our brain cells are involved with movement, including the brain cells we use to think with and plan with and sequence and all the things that we as humans have over the great apes. So when we move, we're actually using a lot more brain cells than in any other activity. And when we use our brain cells, because now we think of our brain as a muscle, just like our biceps when we do curls to increase the size of our muscles, so do when we use our brains, do we challenge our brain cells. And if there's a rest period, if there's recovery and repair that goes on, then we make our brain cells tougher. And as well, we now know since 1999 that we are creating new brain cells all the time. And exercise seems to be the very most potent way of increasing our making new brain cells, especially in the hippocampus, which is an important center for memory and learning, an important center for keeping our brains going for us.
Let me jump in here and ask a really stupid question. It's going to be a really dumb question to you guys because you're all doctors. But when we exercise physically, you can do injury. You can overexercise. You can injure yourself. You can get sprains. You can get all kinds of ligament damage. Can you sprain your brain by exercising it too much? Do you need to let it rest like you let muscles rest?
Well, Dr. Rady has an interesting thing in his book, The Spark, and I think this is kind of revenge. You notice that there's always this person at the gym that is just going like crazy, and they are just putting everybody to shame. They take the weight thing and put it all the way down, and they're pumping iron and everything. Well, the rats that were the genetically programmed to overexercise did not get the cognitive enhancement that you and I get when we do moderate exercise. So it's kind of the revenge. Isn't that right, John? Isn't that in the book?
Yep. And when you go, if you do ultra marathons, up here in Boston, we're all over the marathon. So we know a lot about what happens. When people are training for the marathon, their immune system is turned on high. they're training. That means they're not running a marathon. They're not going the full 26 miles. But and so they're very healthy. They don't have the flu or don't get colds or don't get sick at all. But post-marathon, when they let it all hang out and go the full 26 miles, which is way more than anyone should, they end up with colds and more susceptible to the flu. And all these immune changes occur because you're overdoing it. And what we're learning today, I think, is that perhaps the best kind of exercise is burst, is interval training. You hear that a lot, HIIT, especially from the cardiologist, because that's the best way to train a heart and to make it more responsive, to make it tougher. And the same goes for our brain.
Now, I watched one of your TED Talks yesterday, Dr. Rady, and you began that talk with having the audience stand and do these short burst exercises where they extended their arms out in front of themselves and then brought them in suddenly and then did a squat and came back up and then repeated that movement several times. And when you'd had them go through it about five or six times, you said, okay, sit down, now you're ready to learn. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. I do that all the time because because we know that by doing that, we turn the brain on, and especially the attention system, which is something that I've studied for 40 years now. And exercise is probably next to our stimulants is the best way to treat attention deficit disorder, which is rampant, and one of the big symptoms you get when we talk about cognitive decline is failing attention. And when you exercise, you not only immediately make your attention system sing and really work better for you, but over the long haul, you actually boost your attentional capacity.
So you can focus. Are you saying that you can focus more clearly and more intensely if you exercise?
Exactly.
Why?
And stay with it.
Why? Why does that happen?
Because what you're doing when you're using those brain cells, you're releasing neurotransmitters, and I'll spend a lot of time talking about them tonight and tomorrow in Charlotte, because the same neurotransmitters that we aim for with a lot of our psychiatric medicine, including those medicines we use to help with attentional issues as well as mood issues. And so when you charge up, when you use those brain cells, the same ones that we use to exercise with are turned on, are used, and we increase the concentration of these neurotransmitters just like we hope to do with some of our psychiatric medicine.
What is great about this is not just that it helps people who are older and who are maybe trying to stave off various forms of memory loss, dementia, depression, etc. It also applies to young people. We have an obesity epidemic in this country. Academically, our students, we are told, are lagging behind the rest of the world, which does not have an obesity epidemic, which might indicate a problem with diet and exercise in this country. And you're saying, Doctor, that you observed a number of studies that the benefits of exercise on young people are dramatic, and the more fit the child, the better learner they are.
Right, and a lot of that starts with the evidence that we have with the elderly and with preventing Alzheimer's disease. It was such a focus then, and now we're seeing this in our young people. There was just a wonderful study today that came out looking at exercise as a way of preventing suicidal behavior in bullied kids, which is, you know, the bullying programs and all that. So you get a wide swatch of changes when you exercise and when you are more fit to be involved in life.
Dr. Edwards, I think one of the things that one of the terms that Dr. Rady used a few minutes ago was plasticity or elasticity in the brain. What is that, and how does that benefit us?
Plasticity really talks to how your brain can change over time and whether or not there are new cells that are produced as we age. And the evidence from the mid-90s, as John just said, is that we do create new brain cells, and our brains do have the potential to become more elastic, to change, and also to enhance the connectivity between certain parts of the brain. One of the things that happens when you have cardiovascular disease is that you don't really damage necessarily the areas of the brain, but you damage where they connect to one another and how we can take certain observations and take certain memories and link them up, and we lose that. I think one of the things in John's book that's interesting is that he talks about the runner's high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've done a little bit of running, nothing great, but I never got the runner's high. It was all drudgery, and exercise is drudgery. I don't get that, and apparently 25% of us don't get the endorphin release. And I'm hoping that they're going to isolate the endorphins, and what we'll do is we'll just take the endorphins, skip the exercise, and go drink a couple of beers.
The other things that I mentioned when we started the program is it's exercise, it's diet that plays a role in all this. It's also socialization. Talk to me about why that is, particularly for older people, why having friends and relationships and getting together and talking and just being in groups of people seems to help with your brain health.
Well, one of the things that Hayes just mentioned was that what they do is they take these groups and they say, okay, this group is very socially interactive. They're still going to the symphony and they have their friends and they're very much involved in vital lives. And then you have this other group over here that is inactive, and the incidence of Alzheimer's and dementia in the inactive group is much higher.
Is it because of a lack of stimulation?
Well, I think part of it is that apathy and indifference are one of the first symptoms of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, and it occurs 5 to 7, sometimes 10 years before you have the onset of the cognitive decline and the memory problems. So we may be looking at people that already have it, because it's kind of like with exercise, that there are no apathetic people in a gym. And there are no apathetic people in a new classroom trying to learn French, or there are no apathetic people at the symphony. These are people that are engaged. But having said that, there is an interconnectivity in certain neurotransmitters when we interact with each other that are released, mm-hmm. that are protective. And so I don't want to be too negative about that, but sometimes we kind of overreact to that. Hayes, you might want to...
Yeah, you know, we have an executive health program in Charlotte. It's called Hallmark Care, and we have some executives come in, and all of that social interaction, you know, when people get older, they can't hear as well, they can't see as well, and I think that probably factors into this whole how do you keep the brain motivated and stimulated to learn. You mentioned the whole exercise piece, and when you exercise, your muscles grow when you rest, and I can't overstate the sleep piece of this. You know, we probably need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And when these executives come in and they're traveling, they're probably only sleeping 3 or 4 good hours a night. And so we really, one of our first things we do is we do a full assessment. We look at all of their labs, but then we sit them down with the nutritionist and we talk about, let's really look at your kitchen, what your pantry, what you're eating. We talk about their exercise. But then one of the things we assess is their sleep. And sleep is probably the most underdiagnosed. Sleep apnea is probably the most underdiagnosed disease that's out there right
now. Plus, for executive, not needing a lot of sleep is almost a macho virtue.
Yeah.
I don't need a lot of sleep.
Totally sleep. Overrated.
Yeah.
Because memories are cataloged. That you make observations during the day, but they are not logged into your brain in that file cabinet until you've slept a certain amount of time.
That's your processing time.
Exactly.
Right.
And you have to have it. If you don't get a certain amount of sleep, You don't remember things.
I'm going to talk a lot about nutrition in the next segment, but we mentioned delaying retirement also playing a role in keeping your brain healthy. And there was an article in the paper today, a big interview with Eric Braeden, who is 74 years old. He's an actor. He plays Victor Newman on The Young and the Restless. And he was in town over the weekend to see the Panthers play. And they interviewed him at the Dunhill Hotel. And he said, I'm not going to retire because retirement is death. And here's a guy who has to memorize lines every day of his life for this soap opera that he's on. Why is delaying retirement a healthy thing for your brain?
Well, I would say that... Yeah, go ahead, John.
Go ahead. It keeps you engaged, first and foremost, and it keeps you challenged, and it keeps you with others, and it keeps you in something that you obviously have liked or... suffer through, however you look at your job, but it's something that gets you out of the house, it gets you with a new group, and it has a challenge. Our brain needs to have challenges for it to grow, it's something that is undersold. Retirement is so glorified, and most of the people that are living healthily into their 90s and 100, are working or doing something that's similar to what we would call work. That whether it's doing their garden or collecting or even a moderate amount of involvement will keep our brains clicking.
So it doesn't matter if you've been in the same career for 40 years and you're 65 years old and you're just sick to death of what you do. It doesn't mean you have to keep doing that to stay sharp. You can retire and then go do something else.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very important point. That.
And that actually may be more healthy because doing something else requires you to learn.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to go with this. One of the things that protects us from dementia and from Alzheimer's disease is your education level. If you have a college education, if you take that group, they have a lower –
Go ahead. We'll stop there.
Okay.
Because we have to go to a break, and you saw my finger go up. And
I know.
And you stopped
instantly.
Shut
me down.
So we'll come back to that, because that's a very important point. And we're talking about your educational level playing a role in your propensity to have dementia later in life. We'll come back to that, and we'll talk about nutrition and its impact on the brain in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I just had a memory lapse here off the air, so I'm glad.
I got an appointment at 2 for you.
Thank you very much. We're here with Dr. Charles Edwards, who's Medical Director of the Memory Center Charlotte, Dr. Hayes Woolen, Primary Care Physician and Senior Vice President of Physician Services at Novant Health. He'll be talking about nutrition and the brain in a second. And Dr. John Rady, Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, and his latest book, Go Wild, which is also kind of about the connection of exercise and the brain. But there is a connection, evidently, Dr. Edwards, to the educational level a person has and their propensity to have dementia later in life. Do we understand? If you have a high school education, you're more likely to get dementia than if you have a college education. Are you less likely even than a college-educated person to get dementia if you have a master's degree or a doctorate?
Yes, yeah, those groups, each
Why?
One of those. Well, they're not sure, but they think it might be cognitive preservation, that when we go and we have when we go to college or when we go through a very rigorous academic program, you learn multiple ways of solving problems. And so then you would have a certain number of neurons and pathways that are developed. And I have sort of an opinion about this. We can talk about it if we have time. So that gives you – we're all going to lose brain cells as we age, and so that may give you cognitive reserve so that you just have more brain cells to lose before you lose the ability to solve problems. And having said that, that what happens is that once you decline, though, no matter how much education, everyone declines at the same rate.
So you're bringing in Dr. Majid Fatouhi, if I said his name correctly, because he's participated in a trial where exercise, nutrition, and new knowledge taken together had an impact on brain health. New knowledge, learning. So if you're a high school graduate and you didn't go to college and you're more likely to get dementia later in life, can you offset that?
Yes, you can trump it. You can trump it. And this is really important, and I have a bias here, and I don't want to hit this too hard, but if classic education is what prevents us from getting or protects us in a certain way from getting Alzheimer's disease, then I think that classic education means that you have a certain amount of information that you want to get and that you go and you listen to lectures and you master that, and then you're tested on it. There's long-term potentiation here that the test creates tension. And so now everybody says, well, you can just go and watch Lumosity or PositScience.com and watch those things bang off those. It doesn't do much for me.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because what you're saying is that the way we've learned traditionally, having a teacher at the front of the room lecturing the class, you're listening, you are taking notes, you are then tested on that material, that is a positive. And we're moving away from that in the classroom, which kind of concerns me. But then I was going to ask you, well, okay, we have PBS, we have NPR, we have podcasts now, we have the internet, we have all these ways to take in incredible amounts of information. But it's in a passive way. There's nothing at stake. Yeah. So it doesn't stick as well?
Well, I think that there's something. Eric Kandel, in the 1970s, won the Nobel Prize for a phenomenon called long-term potentiation, and that's how we log memories. Mm-hmm. So if you are confronted with the word triage, and you've never heard it before, you won't remember it. But if it goes back two or three or four or five times, all of a sudden a pathway is established, there's potentiation between those neurons, and you start to remember it. And so I think where this comes down in Hayes and I's approach to this and trying to preserve cognition and to delay Alzheimer's is that we want people to understand that taking classes and taking advantage of the very things you're talking about, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, MIT, online have free courses. You have to take a test to pass it, and you don't get credit to get a degree. But we have never had more opportunities to log into new knowledge than we have now.
But if your degree is not at stake, if the fact that you're plunking down $10,000 to take to get a college education every year or more, and so by gosh, you're going to study and learn. Yeah. If that's not at stake, if you're just going online and oh, here's a great lecture by a great Harvard physician, I'm going to watch this. Will it stick? Will it help achieve in your brain the kind of health that you achieve with a legitimate higher degree?
We don't know. That's what we're going to try to find out.
We've talked about exercise.
I think either you have the sword of Damocles over your head or the excitement mm-hmm. of what you're hearing that will help it stick. If you emotionally get involved in it, either because of you want to pass a test or you want to use it later in your life, or it's so damn exciting that you want this to stick, it will. And that's why today many of our good lecturers are entertainers. They have to grab the audience and keep them on so that they will retain the information. Now, Chuck mentioned Eric Kandel, and that leads to one of, I think, a very important point, is the only way we learn anything is if our brain grows, and that's back to the neuroplasticity. That means our ability of our brain cells to change and grow, and that's what it's about. And so if we don't grow, if our brain doesn't grow the information, we don't remember it.
So it's easy to understand, at least it is for me, because we've done so many shows about exercise and the benefits of exercise, but it's easy to understand how blood flow through the brain increases with exercise, and that can help your brain grow, it can help the development of neurons, etc. Not so easy to understand the impact of nutrition, of diet, on brain health. When did we first recognize that there was an impact?
Oh, I think there's been literally an explosion of data that's coming out about nutrition. There's a Dr. Suzanne Kraft up at Wake Forest who's probably done the most on relating diet with insulin resistance and inflammation. And she talked about for years the cardiovascular effects and what nutrition is doing for the heart. Now all of that
inflammation is very bad for your heart.
Yes, yes. And now we're seeing that there are even more insulin receptors in the brain than there are in any other part
so
of the body.
So if inflammation is bad for your heart and there is a heart-brain connection through vascular problems in the brain, is that why nutrition can be helpful?
We certainly think that's part of the answer, that if you're eating a diet that's high, that causes a lot of inflammation in your body, it certainly is causing the same level of inflammation in your brain, which can then lead to, we think, these amyloid plaques and all the buildup of the toxins in
your
brain.
So what kinds of foods are causing this inflammation and causing these problems? We'll talk about the good foods later, but let's talk about the bad foods.
Yeah, so think about the things that are, you walk into any store, I mean, particularly a 7-Eleven, you see all of those packaged, processed foods, the chips and things with all of these preservatives in there. That causes so much harm to your body. And what happens a lot of times is you get this insulin surge in your body trying to react to the sugar, the carbohydrate load in your system. And over time, that causes a process called insulin resistance. And insulin is very necessary in your body to get the proteins, the nutrition, the glucose that you need into your cells to form these synapses and all of the brain health. But if over time you develop insulin resistance, then you really can't get that nutrition for your brain that your body so needs. And so your brain can't produce all of the good neurotransmitters that it needs to process. And insulin, one of the primary things that insulin does is in your brain is help with memory. And so if you over time you see these people with obesity and metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, they really are having a tough time, and that increases your risk of Alzheimer's almost by 30-40%.
Wow. So let's talk about the good foods, what we should all be eating if we want to keep our minds, our brains healthy. There's a thing called the MIND diet, and it's an acronym. Tell me what it means.
Yes, so the MIND diet is a form of a Mediterranean diet. It's really the Mediterranean DASH diet, which is initially a heart-healthy type of diet.
And DASH is also an acronym for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension.
That's exactly right. And so what they found is a retrospective study. They looked at all of these patients that were supposedly on this heart-healthy diet, and what they found was pretty exciting. When you look at it from a brain health, they found that all of these people were doing much better on their cognitive skills. And in fact, they found that they could reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's for those patients that were very strict to that regimen diet. They could reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's by as much as 54%.
So what is it about the Mediterranean? We've talked about the Mediterranean diet, just being healthy for your body on this program in the past. What is it about the Mediterranean diet that will be brain health?
It's what your mom always told us to do, to eat your fruits and vegetables. You know,
counts me out. Fruits and vegetables. Go ahead.
Yeah, so literally, we don't think that we get nearly enough fruits and vegetables in our diet. The leafy green vegetables, all of those foods that are high in nutritional value, berries. You know, that MIND diet talks about blueberries as one of the most potent foods for reducing inflammation and giving you all the nutrients you need. Cutting back on butter. And if you're going to use oils, use olive oils, and not eating as much processed meats and red meat, that you eat more fish. All of those things can provide good, beneficial effects for your body.
There are 15 components in this MIND diet. Among them, as you said, green leafy vegetables, nuts,
yep,
berries, beans, grains, fish, poultry, no red meat, olive oil, and wine. Every day, a glass of wine, red wine, I assume.
Yeah, for women, one glass a day. For men, you can have as much as two glasses a day. We think that any more than that can actually cause more harm, more inflammation. But okay, the resveratrol in red wine is great for mitochondrial health and promotion of the good nutrients for your brain.
Unhealthy foods, they say, are red meats, butter, margarine, cheese.
Mm. Yeah. It hurts.
It does hurt. Pastries, sweets, or fried or fast food.
All I thought
bad.
Those were the good ones. I got the wrong flyer.
What is it about nuts that make it good for the brain? Do we understand what's going on there?
Yeah, there's a lot of good nutrients. Go ahead, Dr. Rady.
A lot of good nutrients and a lot of protein, It helps with all the cravings for more food, for sure. And a lot of them have omega-3s in it, and omega-3s are certainly one of the most powerful supplements that we have available to us. And a lot of studies are showing that, in contradictory to be sure, but it's showing that the omega-3s are, again, one of those ways of preventing not only heart problems, but also cognitive problems and Alzheimer's disease. And there's a lot of exciting work being done looking at the omega-3s. But also, one of the things I tell my audiences is, look, there's a lot in our diet that we need to pay attention to. One is making sure about vitamin D. Two is having enough curry every week, because it stimulates our own internal ability to deal with all these reactive oxygen species that come up when we're using our brain cells. And cinnamon and a variety of other spices that we have that actually help prevent the problems we get into with inflammation.
Curry and cinnamon.
Yeah, you bring curry up a great point, Dr. Rady. You know, one of the things we talk to our patients about, it's always better to have a diet that's loaded with these antioxidants and curcumin and cinnamon and nuts and berries, all of those good foods. What we want to do as patients is we just want to take a pill. So here, take your vitamin D pill and take your this and that. So I do think that a diet, a heart-healthy diet and a brain-healthy diet like the MIND diet is much more effective than just a supplement pill.
Curcumin is part of the curry, is part of turmeric, and it actually has the effect of binding the misfolded amyloid protein in the brain. Now, it's been controversial because everybody says, well, the incidence of Alzheimer's is much lower in India than it is in the United States. That may or may not be true because culturally it is so devastating for an Indian family to admit that they have a demented relative. But the curcumin is really a hot item because you can see that it binds the amyloid and you can actually test it in the eyes.
We have about 2 minutes left, and Rebecca has emailed, my father was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. My maternal grandfather also had it. Where can I go in Charlotte to get customized nutrition information in hopes of preventing myself from getting Alzheimer's?
Yeah, this Hallmark Care, Novant Health Hallmark Care, is we have Dr. Lily Teglin and Dr. Katie Weeks. We work very closely with Dr. Chuck Edwards on this executive health and preventive health, particularly brain health and cardiovascular health.
Dana on Facebook writes, does a person's level of stress increase their propensity for dementia? And what about people who suffer from anxiety and depression? Quickly.
Very interesting. Quickly. Anxiety and depression. You're giving me something about anxiety right here. Depression is one of the markers for Alzheimer's disease. And it used to be that we would aggressively treat depression, hoping that it would be pseudo-dementia. But actually, it's turned out to be pseudo-depression because a lot of the patients that have the depression, it's the early sign that they have Alzheimer's. Not all, but it is.
Lucy wants to know on Twitter, what about hearing loss? Is that a precursor?
Huge, huge. And we aggressively recommend that anyone with even moderate hearing loss be tested and to get hearing aids because the isolation is a definite marker for Alzheimer's.
So diet, exercise, ongoing long life learning are three ways to keep your brain healthy and maybe stave off dementia and maybe reverse it in some ways. Dr. Charles Edwards, Medical Director of Memory Center Charlotte, Dr. Hayes Woolen with Novant Health, author of Fuel Your Body, Feed Your Mind, and Dr. John Rady at Harvard University, author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise in the Brain. Thanks for the hour.